Welcome, dumbheads, to this week's megasode of MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Monday through Saturday, I drop one micro-podcast per day identifying the dumbest thing on every single goddamn page of Ninjas and Super Spies, the ridiculous RPG from Palladium Books. On Sundays, I combine all the previous week's episodes in one megasode, like this one. If you want to follow along at home, we are reading Revised Ninjas and Super Spies, 7th printing, from the year 2000. Today we're discussing page 79 of Ninjas and Super Spies. We are nearing the end of the vehicle section, and we are on to the optional equipment. We've talked about all the boring stuff, the speed and the basic body and all that, and now we're on to the cool stuff you get to add to your car. It's a mode of transportation, sure, but as a spy, your car is also a status symbol. It's a tremendous waste of company resources, which is one of the most important things about playing a proper genre respecting super spy. And the car is a personal expression of your style. It is a way to express your values in automobile form. It's like the car commercials are always trying to tell us. It's who you are distilled into a consumer decision. So when you're a spy, your car's got to be on point. It's got to be you. And this is the place to do that. Everybody's got a car that can do a car chase, right? That's basic entry-level spy stuff. But maybe one guy has a car that can go all the way up to like 600 miles per hour, and he's like the ex-auto racer, and he's super reckless, and, you know, he's a loose cannon and doesn't play by the rules. And then on the other side, you have somebody whose car can go a mere 200 miles per hour, but he's got, you know, oil slicks and pontoons and an ejector seat. It's a thinking man's car. It's the car for a man who thinks, I may not be able to outrun my foe, but perhaps I could trick him into pursuing me without leaving proper following distance, and then he is mine. So there's a ton of optional equipment here. Some of it you can get for any old vehicle. There's radar systems. There are thief-proof locks, so you don't have to worry about street toughs stealing your spy car, and then having to answer a lot of uncomfortable questions from the board when some teenage hooligan starts oil slicking everybody in town with your stolen wheels. The aforementioned pontoons, of course, for if you need to land your aircraft in water. And then there are some specific options for automobiles. And this is where I think the designer's love of this section really came through. Now, they did love scramjets. I'll give this section that. As we've seen, I think that the designer was keen on scramjets. But the other space and air and water vehicles, I mean, water vehicles only got one small table, and it doesn't even work like all the others. It has speeds automatically listed for all the different types of water vehicles with no explanation of how you would buy more speed for them, unlike all of the air and land vehicles. Clearly, boats bored the shit out of the designer of this game. And helicopters were maybe not far behind. But cars and trucks, man, there are a lot of options. Some of these options have no mechanical effect. They're just little grace notes, little things to tweak your vehicle so that it is just the way you want it. For example, for an extra $200 each, you can have bucket seats that fold down. You can spend $400 on a stereo system, which also does include a cassette player. That is very clearly laid out. Don't let the spy dealer screw you. You are paying $400 for a stereo system, and you deserve that tape deck. So you can listen to Crisscross and get pumped for your mission. Like the acrobatic skill and the gymnastic skill, Daddy Mac and Mac Daddy will both make you jump. There's the camper option, which is just like the luxury accommodations from last time, only you can fit these in the back of a van, where I think, you know, you get slightly less space, but the surprise factor of having a little bed, shower, kitchenette, and minibar in the back of your panel van, that's worth something. How can the ladies resist you? When you invite them out to dinner and a movie, and reveal that both will take place in the back of your van. Some of these are classic gimmicks. You got your ram prow in case you're the ramming type. You've got the oil slick and the vehicle caltrops if you're more of the evasion type. And if you're a pure zoom zoom racer, you've got fuel efficiency and super fuel efficiency. But you know, we were talking about grace notes earlier, about little details. And for my money, no other company gets little fun details quite as right as Palladium does. And that brings us to my favorite of the optional automobile enhancements, the refreshment dispenser. And I quote, because this is important. A built-in unit that delivers coffee, tea, hot chocolate, or hot soup, pick one, from one spout, and soft drinks, milk, ice water, or fruit juice, pick one, from another, must be recharged every few days. This costs $450. So what we have here is two spouts in your dashboard, perhaps, where you can get a nice, cool, refreshing beverage, and then either a hot beverage or some soup for your long trips. But it's all about the implementation. I can't tell you how many times I created a character with this game when I was younger and gave them a spy car. And, you know, I didn't just out of nowhere become boring in my old age. I mean, I've been working on it for a long time, you guys. I was already a pretty boring kid. And so I would often choose the refreshment dispenser and I would sit there and think, you know, who is this character? Real method stuff. Like, I'm trying to get into the character's head. I've got two options. I've got a hot and I've got a cold. What would Wheelie Jenkins want on a long car trip? The boring way to implement this would have been to say, you've got a spout in your dashboard that dispenses a beverage or other liquid of your choice, right? Simple as that. And sure, that liquid could be any of these things I've just listed, but creativity thrives on constraint. Do I drink coffee, tea, hot chocolate, or would I trade the hot beverage slot for something more substantial? Maybe I'm on a lot of stakeouts. Imagine the luxury of being a broke down PI on a stakeout instead of the ubiquitous box of donuts. When your partner asks you what you're going to eat out on the stakeout, you just reach over, flip a switch, and alphabet soup just pours as if by magic out of the dashboard. And if it's tea, what kind of tea is it? We know this isn't just hot water because otherwise you'd be able to make hot chocolate or tea with it. No, this is pre-brewed tea. This is not tea you have to steep. Could we do some manner of 80s action alternate universe where Captain Picard was a captain who served in Vietnam in the military? His Enterprise is a semi that he drives across the country on behalf of some secret scientific espionage organization. Dr. Crusher is the pretty little nurse he left behind when he went to war, and now he comes back to find she's working for this organization and is supposed to ride shotgun with him in the Enterprise. Wesley is her little brat who gets on CB channels with his ham radio, and when Wesley gets on our hard-trucking Captain Picard's nerves, he just reaches over to the dashboard and dispenses some pre-brewed Earl Grey tea and engages on down the highway. In a section of the game that's all about defining your character in terms of miles per hour and number of turrets, this neat little option to decide whether you are a milkman, an ice water man, or a fruit juice man is both my favorite and admittedly the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 80 of Ninjas and Super Spies. We are finishing up the vehicle section at last. I know I'm running out of things to say about vehicles. I think the designers felt the same way, because other than the description of driving suits, flight suits, and space suits on the right-hand side of the page, what we mostly have on this page are gimmicks that allow you to make your vehicle do something that other vehicles do. Gimmicks that press your speedboat into service as a helicopter, for example. Some of these are more aesthetic than useful. The hover engine capability, for example, this is different from a flying car. Look, your spy is no Jay Leno, but for $65,000, you can have a car or truck that at least hovers like a foot and a half off the ground or over calm water. It can go like speed class 5, so you're not going to set any speed records and you're not going to go soaring off into the clouds, but, you know, it's cool to have a car that doesn't touch the ground. That's worth paying $65,000 for. Other options here are more useful, albeit situationally, like the submersible water capability that allows your car or even aircraft to operate underwater like a submarine. And some have the potential to be exploits, like the surface water capability, which allows you to give a ground or air vehicle the ability to perform water maneuvers. It makes it float, it gives it a waterproof undercarriage, and it gives it a propeller-driven engine. Now, it says you can buy up the vehicle's water speed separately from a very low starting point. As I mentioned last time, there actually is no option to increase water speed, but assuming that the GM is willing to be nice and give you that option despite the fact they forgot the table in the book, it's actually probably more cost-effective to buy a Subaru and then turn it into a speedboat than to buy a speedboat. So given the cash, you can make boats fly, you can make cars dive underwater, you can put a helicopter propeller on your pickup so you can help people move into the penthouse, but by far the dumbest option is balloon capability. And I quote, "An inflatable balloon, complete with a hot air generator, is concealed inside the vehicle. When the mechanism is activated, it turns the vehicle into the gondola of the balloon. As with any hot air balloon, there's no real control over direction, and the vehicle will simply travel with the prevailing winds. Still, it makes for a great emergency escape. Either by pilot control or after 4 hours, or if the fabric is seriously punctured, the balloon will start to slowly descend. Cost $12,000. Unlike the other conversion options, there is no bar laid to adding this to any vehicle. So I like to think of this as sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card. No matter what vehicular situation you've managed to get yourself into, there's always the possibility that you've spent that $12,000, and when the evil agents are almost upon you, you just pop open that secret switch, hit the big red button, and a beautiful balloon unfolds out of your, motorcycle or yacht, your orbital shuttle or your 16-wheeler, and you just gently float into the air. There's an implicit decision here, of course, the game does not specifically address, but it's a hot air balloon. It's going to have something on it. Are you going to go for stealth? Are you going to get a pure black balloon with the deluded idea that you're going to balloon your way into secure facilities? I think not. I think this thing's only getting deployed in a situation where you're being chased on foot, and this is your trump card. This is your ability to get away, and there's nothing they can do about it. So it should be taunting. Like, the game is already up. You've won. This is your winning move. So this needs to be like a grinning skull with a bow tie flipping double birds. Like, this needs to be, say you're infiltrating a Nazi base and this is your getaway plan. This needs to be a big white balloon with just emblazoned on it in big black blocky Helvetica print, fuck your Nazi motorcycles. So you could just laugh at them as you fly to safety. Now that said, you don't want to get too cocky because, as the game is quick to remind us, you can't actually steer your balloon. So it does leave something to be desired as an escape method. Also, anybody with a firearm or any kind of sharp throwing weapon, which is most super spies and most ninjas, as far as I'm aware, they may have a chance to cut your little escape short. Nonetheless, $12,000 is not a ton in terms of the vehicle creation rules, and if you buy this balloon, I guarantee you that you're going to find an opportunity to use it to get away. And when that moment comes, it is going to be glorious, and it is going to be dumb. Of all the things you can do with gadgets on this page, from hovering like the hoverboard from Back to the Future, to having the helicopter blades pop out of your car so you can, you know, hover above the street, to cruising around underwater with your waterproof truck and a little periscope, I think for sheer audacity, the balloon transformation ploy is the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 81 of Ninjas and Super Spies, and we are beginning a long, long section of this book. This is the first page of the martial arts form descriptions. There's a big old heading that says, A Compendium of Martial Arts, and that is what we're going to get. Real, fictionalized, and purely fictional, we are about to get 41 martial arts forms. It's a varied lot. There are some very silly forms here, some really puzzling design decisions. I'm really looking forward to this section, but today we have to stop and talk about a central rules conundrum in this game. While I do get a little bit nitty-gritty on this podcast, like I do dig into some minutia, I try not to get bogged down in a lot of dry, like, ways that, like, numbers don't quite fit together. I try to focus on the places where, like, it would indicate something, like, funny or weird about the game world, about the fiction, or ways that it would make your character creation wonky so you'd end up with a weird character. But sometimes the designers of this game fuck up big time, and when they do, it leaves me holding the bag. We can't talk about these 41 martial arts forms we're about to talk about until we talk about the debacle that is the exclusive martial art form rule. Some of the following martial arts forms are marked exclusive. I don't know what this means. The game does not clearly communicate what this means, and I strongly suspect that the game's designers did not know what this meant. So I'm going to break ever so slightly with format. I've made an exhaustive search of this book for every mention of the exclusive form rule. Not just on this page, which is maybe the clearest statement about it, but everywhere in the book. Here, then, is the record of my investigation. On page 9, there are two tables for rolling up martial arts forms. You'll recall this is the table that can direct you to take snake style, even though you probably don't qualify for it. The two tables, the first one is for characters who can pick any primary form. The second table is to pick a secondary form, or to pick any form except the exclusive ones. So if you can take any form, use table 1. If you can only take a secondary, non-exclusive form, then you roll on table 2. On page 47, the dedicated martial artist is instructed to choose two forms, one primary and one secondary, or one exclusive form. And I quote, note, only the dedicated martial artist can select martial arts marked exclusive. On page 49, the wired agent can, quote, choose one martial art form. Any of the 41 martial arts can be selected except exclusive forms. Then we get the same note on page 50 for the gadgeteer, page 52 for the wandering free agent, page 53 for the dreamer gizmeteer, and page 56 for the veteran grunt. Here on page 81, it says, quote, exclusive. When you see the phrase exclusive next to a form, that means it's only available as a primary martial art form. It can't be the second one picked for your dedicated martial arts character. So before it was saying only the dedicated martial artist can take exclusive forms. Here it's saying you can only take exclusive forms as your primary form. A dedicated martial artist can't take it as a secondary form. That's two different things. Okay, so throughout this whole form section, many of the forms are marked exclusive, including one that is explicitly meant to be combined with another martial art form, many that have bonuses to learning other martial arts forms, and some that specifically have to be both a character's primary and secondary style. So like ninjutsu, being a ninja is like being a jet. If you are one, you are one all the way. You don't get another martial art form. So we're getting some mixed messages here. Because under dedicated martial artist, it says you either get one primary and one secondary form or one exclusive form. Now we've got exclusive forms telling us we get a bonus if we get something else as our secondary form. All the way down on page 164, we've got a bunch of rules for converting Heroes Unlimited characters to give them the martial arts forms from this game. We get a bunch of notes saying many of those characters can't have exclusive forms. Notably, the physical training hero from Heroes Unlimited can have an exclusive form at an extra cost. But the only examples given of exclusive forms are ninjutsu and Thai kickboxing, two of those forms that take both your slots. Then there's the Ancient Master special training hero category from Heroes Unlimited. This is the ancient kung fu guy superhero character class, who the book says is, quote, considered to be a dedicated martial artist and can, quote, select two martial arts forms or one exclusive form. And in this case, if he takes one exclusive martial art form, that's a primary. And if he takes two, they're both considered secondary. Then on page 165, we learn about a bunch more superheroes who can't learn exclusive forms, and that's it. That's all the information we have to go on. Then, on the character sheet for the game, which you would think this would be the final authority, right? Like, whatever the fuck they were trying to tell us, there's gonna be a box for what we're supposed to fill in on the character sheet. Well, you'll be happy to know that the character sheet does contain one slot for your primary form, one slot for your secondary form, and one slot for your third form, which nobody gets. So the punchline in this episode, sorely lacking in punchlines, is this. I'm about to make some jokes about various kinds of martial arts only being available to dedicated martial artists, or only being available to the worldly martial artist, or not being available to this class or that class, or if you take this form, then you can't take that form. Please don't write me emails telling me that I'm wrong. There's no way for you to know if I'm right or wrong. There's no way for any of us to know. This is a very fundamental part of the game, and it's all fucked up. So I choose to interpret these vague rules in the way that seems funniest to me at the time. This conundrum is not funny in itself, but it will facilitate jokes, I promise you, and it is the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 82 of Ninjas and Super Spies. This page is honestly a little bit boring. It's mostly descriptions of what we're going to see in the future and the descriptions of these forms. So like, stance. This is stance. Costume. This is what the people wear. A little bit dull and unnecessary, but nothing really worthy of podcasting. So I'm going to cheat slightly and go for something that it's introduced on the previous page, but the relevant passage doesn't end until the top of this one. So I think it's fair game. And it's something that definitely deserves comment because it is a severely poor design decision. This comes under the entrance requirements category, and I quote, the character's unmodified original attributes must match the form's minimum attributes in order for the character to choose that form. Even to get a secondary form, the character's originally rolled stats must meet the minimum, not the attributes, after they've been improved by the primary form's bonuses. So what this means is that hard work will avail you nothing in the hardscrabble world of advanced kung fu. It is completely about your natural gifts, because around the world and across the spectrum of alignment, through the many, many martial arts styles that exist, senseis do not believe in coaching. If you did not meet their standards for physical potential right out of the womb, you're out of luck. It's a hard pass on you. you can go study one of those no standards kung fu styles for betas. They're not going to mess with you. And it's not just that they don't want to coach you. They're not even cool with someone else coaching you. Here's a concrete example of this. For prerequisites, let's go to our old friends, Snake Style. You'll recall that Snake Style is the style that is run by a cabal of shadowy masters who have certain entrance requirements. They require you to be extremely evil, for example. Presumably there's some sort of test, some sort of like little bubbles you have to fill in about under what circumstances would you kill the puppy? And then like you just sit there and like stroke your goatee and like D, all of the above. And then they all nodded at approving like, yes, he seems like a good prospect. But there are other requirements as well. And some of them are physical. It demands that you have a certain physical prowess score. The requirement is actually really low, like 7, which is clumsy as shit. That is well below the bottom 15th percentile, probably more like the bottom 13th percentile of agility in regular people, let alone martial artists. So if you've got a physical prowess of 7, you're extremely clumsy, like romantic comedy clumsy. But despite that, they can work with you. But if it's 6, no way. So okay, let's say you've had the misfortune, just genetically, to have a modest PP. Like, let's say 5. Like, that's not tiny. That's below average. So now you run into the sexy snake kung fu lady you've seen around. You know, with a PP like that, like 5, she's not going to be interested in you. So you decide to compensate by becoming kind of a jock. You take the physical skill program. So you take acrobatics. That's like plus 1d4. Gymnastics. That's another 1d4. Your PP is growing. You're looking down at that character sheet. You're thinking, this is almost too much PP. Surely this is going to be enough. No. You go to this sexy snake lady, probably called something like the Black Garter, and she's like, no way. No amount of sports, no amount of self-improvement you can do can possibly change the fact that genetically, I know that PP is only 5. You're like, shit, she knows my secret. So she's not going to train you. So, okay, you go take a different form, a totally different, you go find a more accommodating sensei. You go study Tai Chi. You learned about these ancient Asian secrets to enlarge your PP, probably on the internet. You're like, fuck yes, let's do this. And it works. So you're now at 11, which is 4 better than what they're asking for over there. Better than the average person now. You've gone from, you know, clumsy as Ally McBeal to like, you can dance unembarrassingly at a wedding. And you know Black Garter's been messing around with a bunch of scrubs with 7, so wait till she gets a load of you. Nothing doing. There is nothing you can do. Despite the fact that this game is full of options for you to pump up that PP, none of it will ever, like, this inadequate PP you were born with is going to be just like a tiny little albatross just dangling off you your whole life. You will never learn Snake Style. Not only is it kind of silly that senseis somehow magically know what your original stats were, but it's also extremely bad design. This is 3d6 down the line. This is, you're rolling your character's fate as you go. You have no choices to make when it comes to rolling stats. And despite all the options this game gives you to alter them, to improve them later and make the character you want to make, which is kind of cool, none of them matter when it comes to style, which is one of the primary things. So I would say most players don't want to play an evil kung fu guy with a snake theme who is part of a secret global cabal of masterminds who all know the death touch. But once in a while, you're going to get that player. And this game is there for them. This game supports this. But you have to roll everything exactly right off the bat before you've made any choices to be able to choose this option. And if you don't, then it is foreclosed to you forever. Despite the fact that you know there are snake guys running around, still as clumsy as Ally McBeal, getting by somehow. Because it doesn't matter what your agility ends up being, it matters what it started as. It is a totally unnecessary limiter on your character's potential, on your player choices, and it is the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 83 of Ninjas and Super Spies, and we're just dipping our toes into the martial arts forms. We've just entered this section, we've gone over some basic ground rules about how these things are going to work. You may have ascertained over the past couple of days that these rules were not fully thought out. It's not clear to me that they knew how the rules worked. It's also not clear to me that they realized they didn't know how these rules worked. This seems like a collection of house rules assembled without anyone noticing that they didn't fit together. There are a lot of ideas briefly picked up and then dropped. And there's no better example of this maybe than this very page. So the first thing we get on this page is a picture of a ninja with one of the many confusingly named chain weapons. I can never remember which is which when it comes to these chain weapons. The picture of the ninja is fine. Confusingly, though, the martial arts that we have on this page are not real martial arts. They are the agent martial arts, which is this book's name for the combat styles introduced in the other modern Palladium games, like Heroes Unlimited, that are for like non-martial arts specialists. These include like basic hand-to-hand, which is like you took a self-defense course, expert hand-to-hand, which is like you had military training in hand-to-hand combat, agent martial arts, which is, it's what all the other games use to model martial arts, and in Ninjas and Super Spies, it's like watered down Taekwondo, kind of. There's assassin hand-to-hand. So what we get on this page is just hand-to-hand basic and hand-to-hand expert, right? And we get all of the traits that we expect from a martial art form from this. Attribute requirements, none. Alignment, doctrine restrictions, none. Skill cost, 1 year. Attacks per melee, 2. Okay. And then when we come to the end, right after weapon katas and modifiers to attacks, we have multiple attackers, 1 maximum. Preferred range, grappling. Simultaneous attacks, attacking without defense. These three entries in the form write-up, multiple attackers, preferred range, and simultaneous attacks, don't show up for any of the other forms. We have 41 martial arts in this book, and only in the first one did these make it, because each of them is the wreckage of an idea that almost is in this book, but not quite. Multiple attackers, it says 1 maximum, and the only other reference I can find to this like capitalized M, capitalized A, multiple attackers, is in the Aikido style, which is the first of the big martial arts, like the real serious business martial arts that the martial arts characters learn in this game. And it says in the note at the end that it's good against an unlimited number of multiple attackers, capitalized, because it has circular parry, multiple dodge, you know, infinite roll with punch, unlimited rice pudding. It's the king of all defense styles. And I think what happened is that by the time they got to Aikido, they gave it so many good defenses against multiple people that they realized they didn't need to have a separate mechanic for multiple attackers. So they just dropped the whole thing. And the only place it gets mentioned is here in basic hand-to-hand combat. The result is that if you learned self-defense at your local YMCA or whatever, then you are the only character in the game who can't deal with two people trying to beat you up. You're like Buridan's ass. You've got two people punching you in the head and you're like, oh, this sucks, but it sucks equally from both sides. I'm just going to stand here and take it because I don't have the cognitive faculties to figure out what to do. So the second entry here is preferred range. It says grappling. So combat range is in this game, but no other combat style lists a preferred range because basically this idea was put into the game and then you can see the grievous wounds where it was like slashed down with the editing machete until it's still taking up space in the book, but it is almost completely irrelevant. If you go actually read the description of what combat range is, it's easy to see why they took out this preferred range idea. There's a wrestler and there's a boxer, right? The two kinds of beefy man that we're most interested in Palladium combat. And the wrestler wants to get really close. The boxer wants to stay at a bit of a distance, a middling distance. And so the combat between them is described as a dance with one advancing and the other retreating, right? But then if you look at what you can do at grappling range, you can do anything but big swingy leg kicks, which neither wrestlers nor boxers are allowed to use. Then there's middle range. There's medium combat range. This is the fighting range that Goldilocks would pick. And at this range, you can do whatever you want, except like leaping kicks. If you don't need to do a running start for your kung fu move, then you can do it from this range. Grapples, punches, kicks, whatever you want. Then there's long range, which is where I don't have anybody in my immediate vicinity I want to beat up, but I don't like the looks of that guy over there, so I'm going to jump over foot first and go pick a fight with him. You'll notice that these are also not things that a boxer or a wrestler would do. In fact, you can grapple from either a, you know, medium or grappling range, and neither of these guys wants to be at long range because all they can do at each other from that range is taunt. It would be like playing an old wrestling game against a real cheesy bastard who just stands outside the ring and taunts you until they build one of their finishers up. Although I do think that an insult fight followed by one decisive decapitation would be a fine combat system for a role-playing game, and someone should definitely get right on that. Now, you can close to a closer combat range automatically if you're a skilled fighter. And it's relatively easy to back off of someone, and almost the only reason you would ever want to would be if you rely a lot on jump kicks. So of the 41 martial arts styles and myriad different combat builds in this game, only the specialized jump kick and fool is going to care really at all about combat range. And no one prefers grappling range, really. You can wrestle someone from anywhere in the room. You're a goddamn ninja. So you can see where when they wrote the first style, they thought this was going to be cool. And then once they bothered to think it through, which is to say, you know, minutes or hours after writing it in the book and then later refusing to delete it, they thought, yeah, that sucks. That when we write our next combat style, let's just drop it. The final category, simultaneous attacks, is kind of still in the game as a thing anybody can do. Here it says attack without defense, which is not a thing that I'm familiar with from the game. But everybody can do what's called simultaneous attacks, which is where normally if someone hits you, you would parry, or you would dodge, or you would use some other specialized defensive maneuver. Instead, what you can do with a simultaneous attack is like, punch me, will you? I punch you. I punch you. How do you like that? And you just both get hit. You have no chance to defend. So it's like that part like three quarters of the way through a Japanese wrestling match where you just stand there and slug each other in the face and just take polite turns. It's like that. You don't bother defending yourself. You just hit them at the same time. To my knowledge, this is not a technique that is taught in basic self-defense classes. You are, I know, taught to go for those eyes or like the, you know, the crotch, the throat, all the key points of basic self-defense. But as far as I know, the suggested remedy for headbutts is not like, if a man grabs you and tries to headbutt you, just fucking headbutt him back. Just you lock him up. Don't let him go. Just headbutt him. Forehead to forehead. The advantage is yours because women have a higher tolerance for pain, so he will give up before you do. The funniest thing, though, is that later Eric Wuchik, who is the main author behind this book, was asked by fans, like, what's the deal with this? There are 41 styles in this book. Only the first one has these things. What were you talking about? And Wuchik, appropriately, very zen about it, is just like, oh yes, those were interesting ideas I would have liked to get into further. Like, further than the first style in the book, I guess. I sincerely wish that I were so chill about just straight up forgetting what I'm talking about in the middle of a published work. Every page of this section is written as though years have passed, the author has grown a beard, and only dimly remembers what he wrote on the last page. And it will be our task to try to somehow stitch all of this together to try to figure out how the fuck ninjas work. The fact that the very first martial art form in the book is the dumbest thing on this page, it is a portent of things to come. Today we're discussing page 84 of Ninjas and Super Spies. We've finally reached the martial arts forms proper. We're now going to get a series of martial arts forms in alphabetical order that are true martial arts forms. Martial arts forms that your martial artist characters take. They get all kinds of special maneuvers from. They get martial arts powers from them. The first of these is Aikido. Aikido is kind of an interesting style. It's an interesting adaptation from real life. I think there was a certain level of real life Aikido present here. You can tell by the description of the Aikido outfit, by the description of the Aikido philosophy. But there was also a desire to have this game have clerics. And I think that that may have battled with the knowledge of actual Aikido somewhat and resulted in a bit of a compromise, a very soft pacifistic art form that is really focused on, you know, not spilling blood so that you can still cast your cure lights every day. That stuff is all interesting, but it's not really what I want to talk about because there's something kind of buried in Aikido, which is a style that's all about like flips and throws and joint locks and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, tactically in the game, it's got lots of interesting options, but there's something hidden in there that I think is a key prerequisite for a game in the spy genre. And I quote, under hand attacks, knife hand knockout. Special. Does no damage, but knocks out an opponent for 2d4 melee rounds. Can only be performed on someone already controlled with a joint lock. Requires a normal strike roll. With this one passage, the dumb spy movie has been coalesced into a single perfect crystal. This is what I want to be doing if I am playing silly James Bond. I think it's actually an interesting design lesson that sometimes a game has to be willing to do something dumb to capture the fun of a dumb genre, a dumb story, or a dumb character. And it delights me that at the very beginning of this section that is going to give us countless and labyrinthine tactical combat options, there is a martial arts form that allows you to very simply twist the bad guy's arm around, judo chop him on the neck, and he falls to the ground unconscious but otherwise unharmed. Just simple as that. One roll, just twist and chop. and he's down. This is more like James Bond than anything else in the book to follow. We've reached the apex. I would have so much fun playing a character who, while everybody else is doing their jump kicks and stuff, just relies on the twist and chop method of like, I'm just a British actor. I can't really do kung fu, but twist and chop. Clearly, I am the world's leading expert in oriental fisticuffs. It's dumb, but it's exactly what this game needs. It's both the dumbest and my favorite thing on this page. Things are going to get more complicated than this and much worse. So if you want to hear me say mean things about this game again, join me next time on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This has been Mega Dumbcast. It is Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, Podbean, your favorite podcatcher, etc., etc. New episodes drop every day, except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big chunk for your binging convenience. MDC, Palladium Books, Ninjas and Super Spies, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Ciambietta. This slightly annoying theme song is Cartoon Battle by Kevin MacLeod, whose work you can find at Incompetech.com. The gong sound effect was recorded by Daniel Simon. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.